Sorry. As some of you may already know and have probably heard, my wife Lacey and I, we lived and worked in China several years ago. And the whole story about how that all came about was that we'd both recently graduated and we were kind of asking the question, you know, God, what do you want us to do exactly? And there was a professor of mine, and he would take teams over to China for 3 weeks at a time for like a short-term missions trip. And I had been volunteering up to that point, teaching English as a second language to Chinese immigrants. And I had kind of started to grow a heart for those people in that part of the world. Also, we kind of always wondered if we were called to do missions, like overseas, international missions. And so we thought, well, this is a good opportunity, you know, to go and see what it's like and see, you know, are we kind of cut out to live in another country? And so we went there, but we'd intended to stay longer than just the 3 weeks because we heard that, you know, for the first sort of 3 weeks, it's like a honeymoon phase. And then for the first 3 months, you kind of got 3 to 6 months, you got culture shock. And it's not until you push through to like a year till you really understand the culture and the place that you're staying. So we went there with my professor with the team, but we decided that afterwards we were going to stay. So when the team went home, we stayed with my professor. And he told us, well, since he lived in that area, he was from that area and he had his parents still there, that he was going to travel to another city and that we could travel with him and he could kind of show us around and help us to find work and those kinds of things. And that was very helpful to us because obviously it was extremely stressful, scary living in another place where you can't speak the language. I mean, we were like in the heart of mainland China, so it's a place that wasn't very westernized. Not a lot of people spoke English, so we really felt out of our comfort zone. We felt sort of like destitute and like, what if something went wrong? We didn't know what was going on and where to go for things and how to communicate. So we relied on him quite heavily. We trusted in him to get us around and to communicate for us and to show us things. And he said that in the city nearby that his sister had a home and that home happened to be vacant and that we could stay there until we got on our feet and found work. And so we went there and we stayed there for a bit even though we were still scared. And then he kind of just took off and left us. And we tried to get a hold of him, but we couldn't really get a hold of him for a few weeks. Then he came back one day and told us that we couldn't stay there anymore. We had to leave right away and that we had to pay him rent for the time that we had stayed. And it was quite a lot of money, as much as you would have paid at a nice hotel, and it was the rest of the money that we had. So now we had, like, no money. I remember calling my dad, like, managed to get through with, like, a phone card and phoned him, and I was like, Dad, I'm stranded. I got no money. Can you, like, wire me money? And it was really desperate. We had put all of our trust in this man, and now we felt like he had totally abandoned us. And I remember sitting with Lacey on the bed that night, and we were contemplating whether to book a ticket the next day to fly home. We were ready to completely abandon what God had called us to do because we had put our trust in this man more than God. And I knew right away that I had put my trust in this man more than I should have, and that I was trusting him, not God, because I wasn't able to say, well, God's still going to take care of us, and we'll find a way, and this is part of his plan. Rather, I had lost all my hope. All my hope had gone away, and I felt like I had no more recourse, and I was ready to just run away. And my question for you is, have you ever had an experience like this? And I think chances are you probably have, where you've trusted in someone or something, and then they broke your trust, or they didn't come through, or they failed, or they abandoned you. Maybe you put your trust in yourself, but then you failed, and then you were frustrated and angry. You didn't know what to do with that. Has that ever happened to you? See, today and over the next few weeks, we're going to be talking about this issue of trust. And not just trust, but about misplaced trust and how that comes to us through the story of Gideon. Now, some of you may not be familiar with that story. It's one of these lesser-known stories of the Old Testament of the Bible. But it's a story that comes to us in the book of Judges in the beginning of chapter 6. And at this point in that story, in the history of God's people of Israel, they had come out of Egypt, out of captivity. God's delivered them. He's brought them into the great promised land. But this is the time, sort of after the Ten Commandments, but before Israel was really a nation and had all the kings and all that stuff that we read about in like 1 and 2 Kings. So that's the story of Judges. And the story of Judges really is a cyclical book. It tells the same story kind of again and again and again and again. And it's a story of God establishing his people and saying, I will guide you, I will be your king, I will lead you, and if you follow me, I will protect you. And I will take care of you like a good father, like a good king, like a good leader of sorts. And I will protect you from harm, from the nations, and I will give you prosperity. But then God's people saying, no, actually, we'd rather trust in idols. And we'd like to follow these other gods and trust in idols and foreign gods and other things and other people other than you. And then God's saying, okay, you want to do that? I'm a gentleman. I won't force myself on you. So if you don't want me to be your leader, I won't be your leader. You can lead yourself. And so the people naturally fall into bad times. Surrounding nations come in. They take them over. They're oppressed. You know, I mean, those were rough times. So if you didn't have a mighty king watching over you, protecting you, you were likely to be raided by surrounding nations, and that's what would happen. Then the people would obviously cry out to God in their distress. God, help us, we need you. And then he would bring up a judge to help the people. And it's a judge not like we understand judges. It wasn't like a law judge, but it would be like a leader. And God would bring this person up from within the people and would supernaturally call them and empower them to deliver the people from their enemies. And they would enter into a time of prosperity until that judge died, and then they would repeat said cycle when the leader wasn't there to keep them close to God anymore. And commentators have actually broken this down into a four-part cycle. And I'll just go through it briefly because it helps us to understand the book of Judges that we're going to be walking through for the next few weeks. The first stage, as I mentioned, is apostasy, which is that the Israelites, they basically abandon God, okay? They do, as the text says, they do evil in the sight of the Lord. Secondly, the second stage is servitude. So God allows the surrounding nations to conquer them, right? He removes his protection, the surrounding nations come in, they conquer them. Then, of course, supplication, they cry out to God, God, we need your help. And then fourthly, deliverance, or salvation in this case, God sends a judge to deliver the people from their circumstance, and they follow God as long as that person is alive, and then that person dies, and the cycle repeats itself over and over again. And we see this all through the book of Judges. So when we arrive at Judges chapter 6, which is what we're going to be looking at, which is the story of Gideon, they're at the very beginning of the cycle. They're at the apostasy stage. And so I'm going to read the beginning of the account for you. If you don't have a Bible, don't worry about it. We'll have the words up on the screen here. I'm going to be reading from the New Living Translation because it's a modern translation that is fairly easy to read and to understand the meaning. And this is what God's Word says. The Israelites did evil in the Lord's sight. So the Lord handed them over to the Midianites for 7 years. The Midianites were so cruel that the Israelites made hiding places for themselves in the mountains, caves, and strongholds. Whenever the Israelites planted their crops, marauders from Midian, Amalek, and the people of the east would attack Israel, camping in the land and destroying crops as far away as Gaza. They left the Israelites with nothing to eat, taking all the sheep, goats, cattle, and donkeys. These enemy hordes coming with their livestock and tents were as thick as locusts. They arrived on droves of camels, too numerous to count, and they stayed until the land was stripped bare. So Israel was reduced to starvation by the Midianites. Then the Israelites cried out to the Lord for help. When they cried out to the Lord because of Midian, the Lord sent a prophet to the Israelites. He said, "This is what the Lord, the God of Israel, says. I brought you up out of slavery in Egypt. I rescued you from the Egyptians and from all who oppressed you. I drove out before you your enemies and gave you their land. I told you, I am the Lord your God. You must not worship the gods of the Amorites in whose land you now live. But you have not listened to me." So here we see it's at the time where the people of God were being oppressed by a foreign nation, particularly the Midianites in this case. And the Bible says that this is happening because, again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. Again, the Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. But you might be wondering, what exactly does that mean, did evil in the eyes of the Lord? Like, what does that look like? What exactly are they doing? Well, it doesn't say here in this passage because it already explains it earlier. Remember, there's cycles. So this cycle has already happened before. So back in chapter 2, we see it actually explain what it means to do evil in the eyes of the Lord. Chapter 2 of Judges says, "The Israelites did evil in the Lord's sight and served the images of Baal. They abandoned the Lord, the God of their ancestors, who brought them out of Egypt. They went after other gods, worshiping the gods of the people around them, and they angered the Lord. They abandoned the Lord to serve Baal and the image of Ashtoreth. So here we see the people of Israel are committing a sin. And it's the gravest sin of all, because it's the first commandment of the Ten Commandments. We know the Ten Commandments. We've heard about those. We know they're a big deal. And they're still very important to Christians today. But it was even bigger of a deal to the Israelites back then, because remember, they had recently received the Ten Commandments from Moses himself, really from God himself to Moses, written on stone tablets coming down the mountain, that whole scene. They'd recently received this, so it was kind of ingrained in them. And the first commandment was like the most important commandment. It summarized all the other commandments. It was very important. And this was simple. You shall have no other gods before me. Plain and simple, right? He was speaking against idolatry. But the Israelites, they were very much tempted to serve other gods, the so-called gods of the surrounding nations, right? And I think we give them a hard time often, the Israelites. We think, wow, these people, they're really silly people. I mean, come on, he just parted the sea, he just gave you these commandments from the mountains and the fire and the cloud. He's given you this promised land, all these things, and now you're just so quickly to, you know, abandon him and go after other gods and idols. But we need to understand that we're probably no different than them. And if we were in the same situation, we might have done a similar thing. But there was many differences of the people and of the culture that made them want to do these kinds of things. For example, it was a culture where they had a very spiritual worldview, right? So today, just like we put our faith in like science and understanding that science is a force that drives things and is the reason why things happen the way they happen. Well, so too, they thought that spiritual forces are the reasons why things happen largely. So things like weather and why this went your way and this thing didn't go your way and those kinds of things. So they really felt like this was important. And so religion and God was a very important thing to people's day-to-day living. And to serve a God of Israel was to serve essentially an invisible God, right? He was a God that said, you can't have any images of me. You can't set up idols or statues or anything like that. But the other gods of the surrounding nations, well, they had places where you could go and they would be set up and you could see it. It would be like in the town square and there would be little miniature idols of them. You could take that and you could put that into your home and you could make sacrifices and touch it and those kinds of things and put oil on. So it was more tangible, right? It was more accessible to the people who really felt they needed help of God or our gods to make their lives go well. And secondly, there was a sense that these gods could be used or helpful, maybe to use a crass term, manipulated for someone's own benefit, because these gods had specific roles. Most importantly was fertility. So a lot of these gods like Baal and Ashtoreth, those were fertility gods. And fertility, important to these people these days, right? Because children and crops is what it was all about, right? They were agrarian culture. Children were the workforce, and your livelihood depended on really things like the weather. You know, whether there was drought or enough rain or cold or how that happened. And those are forces. When you don't understand things like science, even when we do understand science, it seems very much out of our control, those types of things, right? They're in the realms of the gods. And so there was a lot of temptation to be able to make a sacrifice to a god that you believed if you appeased them and did certain things and observed certain things, that god would show favor upon you in their area of expertise, i.e. fertility, and you would, you know, have a bumper crop that year and things like that. And this was very important for them. And remember, all the surrounding nations, all their friends, are worshiping these gods and these idols. So there's a sense that they would have had stories probably. Like someone, they would have known people that were like, hey, you know, my wife couldn't get pregnant. We didn't have any kids. Then we went to this god and we, you know, followed the rules and we sacrificed. And bam, she was pregnant. Or I had this drought and my crops were going to fail this year. But I made offerings to this statue, and then now the rain came, you know. And so it would have been very tempting to them, right? It's like when everyone's jumping off a bridge, would you? I don't know. If everyone's worshiping the idols, would you? In this case, they were, right? They were doing that. There was a lot of temptation to follow these idols. So these idols were essentially like man-made things, but they were also serving our own needs and our own desires, right? And that's the same thing we do today with other things, and that's what they were doing, and they were running after these other gods. Instead of worshiping the true God, who is invisible and who controls all things, they were wanting to worship gods that they could control, manipulate, and could keep to themselves and could see and touch. And that was a real temptation to these people. And it was really about trust. What were they willing to trust? And they, just like we trust in our own efforts and the economy and our savings and our talents and our families and our friends and science and all these kinds of things. So they were trusting in these gods and these idols, and they weren't trusting the one true God. And that's really what the whole story of Gideon is and the whole story of the book of Judges. It's about people trusting something or someone else other than God. And this is key. So listen very carefully here. Where you trust, that is where your idol is. Whatever you trust in, that thing is your idol. Now, realize, I should probably make a caveat here. There are going to be lots of things in this world that you trust. Lots of different things that you trust to varying extents. But when you trust in something more than you trust in God, then at that point, that thing has become an idol to the level that you trust in it. So the question I have for you then is, where do you put your trust? Where do you put your trust? I think you've got to ask yourself that question. Be honest with yourself. What is that thing that would be really hard, if not impossible, you feel, to live your life without? Chances are that as I've been giving this message, you know, we always internalize messages. Perhaps you've already had something come to mind. What I would like you to do is I'd like you to actually phrase that either into a word or maybe a short phrase and write that down. There's been pieces of paper that are, you have paper in the seat backs, you have paper some on your seats too, and there's some pens around. What I'd like you to do is pick up one of those right now, one of those pieces of paper, not an offering envelope, okay, and pick up a pen, and you don't have to show anybody this, okay, this is between you and the Lord, but I'd like you to, if you could, identify what is that thing that you feel you are trusting or potentially trusting in more than God. Sometimes, if not all the time. What is that thing? So just give you a second. I wrote mine down and I put it in my wall on a piece of paper because I knew I would forget to bring a pen up. But I wrote it down too, and I have one in my wallet. And the thing we need to realize is that if we are trusting that thing more than God, then that thing is an idol, and we are practicing idolatry. You know, it's a different form, it looks a little different, but it's the same. What's interesting is that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the civil rights guy, he's known for his work in civil rights, but he was actually well known in those times for his work on idolatry. See, his doctorate work was actually in the field of study of Christian idolatry, right? Because he was a minister, he had a PhD in theology. And this is what he says in his dissertation. Many one thinks that he has God and everything in abundance when he has money and possessions. He trusts in them and boasts of them with such firmness and assurance as to care for no one. Lo, such a man also has a God, material by name, on which he sets all his heart, and which also is the most common idol on earth. What he says here is quite true. Money and possessions, material things, right? This, I do think, is the most common idol we can have in our lives. Remember, back to the Israelites, fertility, right? That was essentially their form of wealth, right? How many children you had, how well your crops were, and how many crops you had. That was essentially material wealth and prosperity in that culture. And they were worshiping those things. But realize that it's not always money and possessions. It can be many other things and can take other forms. Martin Luther King goes on. So too, whoever trusts and boasts that he possesses great skill, prudence, power, favor, friendship, honor, has also a God, but not our true and only God. Therefore, I repeat that the chief explanation of this point is that to have a God is to have something in which the heart entirely trusts. Thus it is with all idolatry, for it consists merely in erecting an image and worshiping it. But rather in the heart. So what he's saying here, my friends, is that idolatry is essentially a matter of the heart. Idolatry is a matter of the heart. It's in your heart of hearts. What is it that you are trusting more than God? The Bible often refers to this as faith. It uses faith and trust sort of interchangeably. And so it's, where do you put your faith? Where is your faith? I think if someone were to ask you, what is your faith? You would probably say, Christianity, right? We use that word, faith, Christianity. But if you were to truly believe that you're going to be fine and your life's okay because you're an educated person and you have a good job and you have some savings, and that's what your self-confidence is based on, then to say my faith is Christianity would be sort of a misnomer. Rather, I think it would be more accurate to say my faith is selfianity, because that's where your faith is. That's where you put your trust. You put your trust in yourself and not God. And at least by saying my selfianity, we would be a little bit more honest. I'm not saying everyone, but maybe that resonates with me a little bit. And so the question is, who do you trust? What do you trust? Where is your trust laying? If you remember back to the story, I started out here in the foreign country, and I was wanting to trust in something because I was in a precarious situation, right? I felt vulnerable. When we're vulnerable, we want to flee from that. We want to feel safe and secure. I reached out to something. I couldn't rely on myself, actually, because my language skills, my communication, my life experience, my know-how, my street knowledge, okay, you got street smarts, none of that was useful to me in this place, right? So I relied on someone who had those things. Now I decided to put my trust in my professor who understood the culture, who understood the language, who could get around. And when he failed me, I knew right away I'd been trusting him more than God because of how much it hurt me. To say that it hurt me would be a bit of an understatement. When he sort of abandoned us and kind of retracted his help, I probably felt destitute. I felt hopeless. I felt crushed, right? And that's how you know when something is an idol. How much does it disturb you when that thing fails you? To the degree which it disturbs you, that is the degree to which it has become an idol in your heart. An idol is something that is very unforgiving, and if it was to be taken away from you, you wouldn't know what to do with yourself. Your life may be done. I can recall me and Lacey, you know, when we were sitting there and we were on that bed and we were thinking about canceling our whole year in China and just going back home. I can remember then that if I had put my trust in God in that moment, I wouldn't have felt so scared. I wouldn't have felt absolutely devastated and crushed, because I would have said, you know what, but ultimately, God's going to take care of me. I would say, you know what, if God called me here and he wants me to do this, then he's going to provide and equip me to do that which he's called me to do. So I shouldn't be worried. Or I would say, you know what, this situation is bad and all, but this is part of God's plan for me. Because I know that he's called me, and I know that he's in control. I know he's in this room with me. I know that he always provides for me. Man, that's something he's been teaching me time and time again. He says, I take care of the sparrows. I take care of the doves. Aren't you more valuable than them? I'm so much more valuable to God than all these things. He's always watching me. He counts every hair on my head. He knows me. Right? I can trust in him, but I wasn't trusting in him. That's why I was so devastated. You see, that's how you can tell how much something is an idol in your life. So if you think to yourself, there's this thing, and maybe it's the thing you wrote down, and you think, there is no way that I could go on living if I didn't have that thing anymore, then my friends, that thing is certainly an idol for you. I used to know a guy, I still know him, let's call him Tim for the story's sake. And Tim was a very smart, handsome, well-adjusted guy. He was also athletic like you wouldn't believe, okay? And he was strong, and he was big, and he came from a good family, and he grew up playing hockey, and he had real prospects of being in the NHL. But then about that time that one makes their transition to the NHL, he got into an accident, and he became paralyzed from the waist down. And he went into a very deep depression for a number of years. And I can imagine probably, you know, even contemplated suicide many times, because what he had put his trust in you know, essentially his body and his career hopes. Ultimately, they had come crashing down. They had failed him. And Christians, sometimes we get crushed like this under things. But we shouldn't, because we have not something but someone who we trust in more than these things. And what's interesting about that someone is that someone will never fail us. The Bible says that God will never fail us. He will never forsake us. He will never leave us. That's amazing. Not only can he never fail us, but also says he'll never leave us. Because we've all had people that are very trustworthy, but then they leave us. You know, we can fail ourselves, right? We can only control so much. You know, our bodies can, we could be in a car accident the next day, or the economy could turn around and we could lose all of our investments, or we could lose our job at a moment's notice. I mean, it's very frail, if you think about it. These things that we've built our lives on, that we trust, and we think that if I have this thing, then I'm going to be okay, realize that that's pretty precarious, right? Maybe nothing's happened yet, but it could take a moment. And everything could change. And realize that when you build your faith on God, who is unchanging and will never leave you or forsake you, and who is eternal, that is the strongest foundation you could ever have. Right? If you build your house on that, it is solid. And anything you build on that, even if it's shoddy, that's going to stand strong because the foundation is firm. Right? But think about the other way. If you built your life like Tim on your athleticism or your body, when the storms of life come and it rains, your foundation is going to be shaky because your foundation is actually built on sand. And when sand gets wet, it just turns to mush. It doesn't matter how grand the building is or how firm that is, how wonderful and opulent that house is, that when the foundation starts to crumble, the whole thing will fall. And that is how precarious your life is. If it's built on anything other than God, first and foremost, then you're living on a fence. And at any moment, you could fall off of it. You realize that it's very, very, very shaky. God is the ultimate foundation. So I would encourage you to put faith in God. Trust in God. No amount of trust you can place in God will ever be misplaced. You can't put too much in it, right? Because he will never change. He will never leave you. He will never forsake you, right? So you know that your trust will always be well-founded in God. You can't go wrong. And so I encourage you, with that piece of paper, that thing you got, that's something maybe that at certain points in your life, or maybe all the time, is something you're trusting more than God, then realize you're in a bad position. And what I want you to do is just take that piece of paper and put it in your pocket or your wallet or your purse or wherever. And then in the coming day or weeks, when you come across that piece of paper, do with it as you would do with any worthless, useless piece of paper. You just throw it out. Crumple it up, rip it up, whatever, just toss it away. And know that is what you must be willing to do with everything in your life. Even that thing which you think you value so much. Even if it's something like family. Realize your family can leave you. Your family can be taken away. It doesn't actually even take that much. Realize that even though it may be the most noble sounding thing, that your life is only secure as that thing. And you need to be able to say to that thing, I can toss you away. And I would still be okay because my trust and my faith is secure in God. That is my prayer and my hope for you. And as you go through life, I think the Christian life really is a part of trusting God more and more and more and deeper levels and holding more loosely to these other things in life that we use to prop ourselves up. And so that's my prayer for you. And I would love to just go before our Father, as his son, and just ask him on behalf of you, his children and my fellow brothers and sisters, that he would help you in this. And anytime he does something that disrupts that idol, realize that that is a good thing. And he's showing you grace when he does that. Because Lord help you if it ever were to go away entirely. Usually when he does that, he's just showing you, do you see how worthless this is? Do you see how precarious this is? Let go of this and hold on to me. So let me just pray for you. Dad, I thank you that you love me so much. And I thank you that many times in my life, I've seen you come in and shake up my foundation. You've challenged and taken away different things that I've sort of used to prop up the foundation of my life. And Lord, you've shown me just how weak those things are, how frail they are, how fleeting they are, how they could be gone tomorrow. Lord, I thank you for that grace and that you've built up my faith. Lord, that thing that I wrote down that's in my pocket, Lord, I surrender that to you. I totally give that to you. And I pray that you would just lessen the importance that thing has in my life and that you would increase my trust in you. That even if that thing were to be taken away, that my life would still go on. That I wouldn't want to not go on living. Lord, that's my prayer for my brothers and sisters here today. Lord, that you would be as gracious to them as you've been to me in my life. Lord, help them to identify very clearly what it is in their life that's taking your place. Help them to, through your Holy Spirit, be able to step off of the throne that's in their life and to put you on the throne of their life. Or to take whatever that thing is off the throne and to put you on the throne in your proper place. Lord, would you do this, Lord, for your sake and for your glory, that we would live more for you every single day and that others would look at us and that they would be able to see that we have a hope much greater than anything this life can provide. Amen.